Hello, and welcome back to season three of the No Stupid Questions podcast. And I really want to kick off this season with a few thank yous. So, first, big shout out to Brixham Finishing School, who are the reason this space exists, to all the curators behind the scenes who keep this podcast going, and to every one of you lot for listening. And to show our thanks for your ears, we have lined up a remarkable guest for you. This is someone who's held titles including CEO, trustee, and OBE. This industry triple threat is Karen Blackett, WPP's UK president. So, who is she? Well, she's a proven business leader with a unique ability to create vibrant cultures, energize teams, and consistently deliver business growth, all while maintaining her trademark warm, charming, and consistently composed manner. Karen is a cheerleader for non-traditional talent. She knows inclusion advances business success and has proved it with initiatives like Visible Start, a digital and data program that's brought 700 plus midlife women closer to the industry, Elevate, a mentoring program for Black women, and as a founding trustee of the Black Equity organization that exists to create better lived experiences for Black people across the UK. Now, Karen has not only launched a series of impactful initiatives, she was recently appointed non-executive director at Diageo. And it doesn't need to be said because it is so clearly evident, but Karen is a committed change maker and she shows up as one in every role she holds. In this episode with Karen, we'll be discussing the blunders and blessings she's experienced across her career. And by that, we mean the lessons learned from making foolish decisions at times. Now, as we always say on this pod, success isn't getting it right, it's learning. So now it's time to hear from the woman herself, Karen Blackett. OVE.
Karen, hello.
Hello, Priscilla. Really good to see you and hear you sounding beautiful this morning.
That is very gracious of you. I am so excited to chat to you today.
Same here. I really am. And you'll have to stop me talking because I can talk for England.
I love that. The listeners are going to have joy hearing everything you have to say. So, should we kick off?
Please do. Let's.
Can you enlighten us? Can you tell us three learnings that have helped you manage a fear of failure?
So I am actually, look, I am going to confess that I am actually here in my role in advertising and the creative industries because I am a failed athlete. That was actually my first passion and love. And I was a sprinter, a relay runner, and a long jumper. And there was a lot in athletics and the training that I had that I bring into my professional life now at work. And there's a lot in terms of similarities, in terms of fear of not getting a personal best, fear of not being picked for, you didn't get the qualifying time that you needed to get into a team, fear of losing a race on the final leg or losing an advantage on the third leg of a relay. So there's a lot of fears that I had from athletics, which are similar to fears that I have professionally. The thing that I learned to try and overcome the fear is about practice and rehearsal. So I could win the 100 meters. I mean, I really should have been an indoor athletics person rather than outdoor because I was better over 60 meters than 100, but I could win the 100 meters if I got a good start. So I'd practice over and over again my start. I'd practice it on my blocks over and over and over and help me with big events, big meetings, big presentations at work. I practice. It's not something that I wing. I can't. I have to practice. So that's the first thing that really helps me, because I'm really practiced at it. I've rehearsed it. So I've become comfortable with it. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I think everybody needs a coach. So again, in my athletics career, I had a coach. In my personal life, I have a life coach. I've had a life coach, I mean, God, since God was a boy, for about 15 plus years. The coach is somebody that helps me overcome my fears as well. So when I have, and everybody has, unless you're Donald Trump, everybody has imposter syndrome. Everybody has those moments of, I'm not sure if I can do this. I'm not sure if I belong in this room. I'm not sure. And for me, my coach helps me. And he's not one of those coaches that just lets you talk and they don't actually say anything. He does actually pose questions that I have to answer and give me feedback. And I believe feedback is a gift. I really genuinely believe feedback's there to help you get better. And I had that in when my athletics career as well, when I was running, I had a coach who gave me feedback. They fed back about my start. They fed back about my hitch kick technique for long jump. So I had feedback, and I think it's a gift. And I think a coach can help you. They really can. And it doesn't have to be, you know, a professional coach. It could be a mentor. It could be a sponsor, but somebody that's going to give you feedback, and that helps you overcome your fears, because they may see the areas that are the unknown to you that they can see, that helps you conquer those things that could come up and make you fall or trip you up. And then the last thing, I think I call them cheerleaders, which are just a bunch of people that I have met along my way, along my journey, who we've met randomly and we've just got on and we've got great chemistry and we find that we've got similar stories or we've trodden a similar path, and they end up cheerleading you just as much as you cheerlead them in order to fly and progress. Those cheerleaders, again, are the people that you can talk to about things that you may be feeling fearful of, so that you can talk it out. Because I do think talking's really important. You've got to recognize how you're feeling and share it, and that will really help. So practice is really important. Feedback is a gift. Somebody that could feedback and coach, and then those cheerleaders where you can talk it out how you're feeling and give you the verbal slap that you need to keep going.
That is amazing and so practical as well. That is something that people can really take away and learn how to manage that fear that they might have. But I think the thing that really stood out to me when you were speaking there was the fear doesn't really go away. It's just about what you do with it.
I genuinely believe that if you don't have those little butterflies in your stomach, or, you know, that feeling of anxiety, or you're not taking it seriously. And it's not that you're not confident, because you can be confident and still be fearful. And it's just about making sure it doesn't get out of hand, that you can manage it and that you can contain it and it doesn't affect your performance. So for me, it helps with that bit of adrenaline, that little bit of anxiety, but it's making sure you contain it so it doesn't get out of hand. But that means I'm taking it seriously. If I didn't have that little butterfly in my stomach, it means it's something I don't care about. So for me, it's a sign I care.
That's really powerful, that it is a sign that you care, and reframing it as a positive. It's a thing that means that you're doing what you should be doing, almost, because you
totally. We all have those moments where we're totally out of our comfort zone. You can go down a rabbit hole and go into complete panic. Or we all have, and I know I have had, moments in meetings that even though I've practiced and rehearsed, something's happened. There's been some sort of curveball and it's not been what I expected, and it's knowing that that's okay and just not letting it take control. And I have seen blind panic on people where the fear's taken control. And that's where, if you are a good colleague, a good wing person, you help, you step in and you help.
That is probably a perfect word into the next question. So going from preparation to panic,
yeah.
Can you tell us about your biggest blunder and the blessing that followed?
I'm not sure if it was a blunder, but it was an accidental blunder. It was quite a few years ago. So I can't remember if I was the marketing director or if I was a business director running a set of accounts. I was going along with my boss, who has been a massive sponsor of my career, a guy at Essence MediaCom, the global CEO, Nick Lawson, and he was CEO of the agency I was in at the time, which I think we were MediaCom then, not the media business. And we were going along to a chemistry meeting for a pitch of a client that we had been courting for about 3 or 4 years. And it was early morning meeting, and it was actually going to be with their ad agency that was working with them at the time, as well as the client. And it was a really early morning meeting. And I remember we'd had a taxi booked to get us there, and we wanted to get there, and he's a bit like me, he doesn't want to leave things last minute, so we always make sure that we leave plenty of time so you're not flustered when you walk in because you're panicking to get there. And part of what helps with my confidence is dressing the part as well, so knowing that I look good, knowing that I've got this. So I'd got this sort of new powder blue power suit, sort of trouser suit that I'd got, and I was looking sharp, Priscilla. I was going to look the part. And I remember getting into the car and sort of sitting down with my boss and just hearing this, and I just was frozen in fear, and I could feel a cold leather seat on my bum. I could feel, and I literally just looked at my boss and I was like, oh my God, I think I split my trousers. And it was early in the morning, so it was before any shops had opened, and where we were going, it was sort of around, it was Fitzrovia, so it was sort of around the back of Oxford Street, that area. And I remember saying to my boss, oh my God, oh my God, is it bad? Is it bad? And I remember sort of lifting up one bum cheek for him to sort of try and see, and I could see in his face that he was trying not to reveal how bad it was, but it was clearly bad. He was, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, I'll walk in behind you, it'll be fine, I'll keep my jacket open and walk in behind you, it'll be fine. And I was like, Nick, is it bad, is it bad? He's like, no, we'll be fine, we can't do anything, we've got to go. So he then started panicking because he was thinking, well, he didn't want to go to the meeting on their own because I had all the knowledge and what we were doing in my head, and also it was a chemistry meeting, so I can be quite good at sort of breaking down the barriers and the ice to get to the crux of what we need. And he was like thinking, well, she's got to come, she can't not come. So he was panicking. I then literally, having gone into the car confident, I knew it and rehearsed, I was then in a total panic because I could feel flesh. Literally could feel flesh. And I was literally saying to Nick, I've got this. I can't walk in like this. I've got to buy something. As we're driving, everything's shut. It's literally before 8:30. Everything's shut. There's no shops open. But the area that we're in, it's where it's got all the wholesale retailers. Mm. I could see some people in some of the windows of the, and I was just, I was like, stop the car. And I just got out and I just started, I mean, my backside was exposed to whoever was walking past on the street, and I just started banging on doors and banging on windows to try and get somebody to open and let me in. And I tried two or three before one took pity on me because they could see the panic in my face. I turned round so they could see the issue and they let me in, and they're not meant to sell to the public. I didn't care what it was. I mean, it didn't match the outfit at all. I didn't care. It was just something that was going to cover my backside. Bought this skirt and I was like, thank God. And then my boss was like, oh, thank God. So we got back in the car and it was only another, 5 minutes to where we were going. So I then calmed down and started breathing properly again. I was thinking, okay, I'm good. And of course, because my boss was quite nervous about this meeting as well, he then decided to retell the entire story as we walk in the door to try and be the icebreaker to the client. So I was mortified. I was absolutely mortified. And then he was doing the actions of how he was going to try and cover it up. I mean, it was good because they clearly warmed to us because it was a real life human story, but it was mortifying. And look, the thing for me is the blessing from that is even when something looks as though it is beyond retrievable, you can find a solution, find a way of handling it. And resilience and persistence was something that really helped me because I was banging on those doors until somebody opened it, and the power of persuasion to let me buy something directly. Never have planned for that scenario going wrong. You learn to pivot and you learn to deal with it.
I'm just filled with so much horror. But then the way that you beautifully rounded that off, there's so much hope. And that is just wild. I mean,
honestly, the person, there was flesh, Priscilla. There was no, it wasn't a tiny little tear. My bum cheeks were hanging out, thinking, can I wrap my jacket around my waist? That's the thing there, you find a solution.
Keeping control of the fear 100%. Yeah. Because you found a sense of clarity amid the chaos to just go, right, we're in an area of dressmaking and tailors. They may not sell to the public, but they will today. Not totally.
I mean, I must have looked like some wild black woman banging the doors of these shops at God knows what hour it was in the morning, but they could see how upset I was. They only had to turn around and they could see my dilemma.
Honourable mention to whoever you were, save the day.
Totally, honestly, totally.
One of the things that really stands out in that story is just how brave you are.
I don't know if it's bravery, I just think it's persistence.
Yeah.
It's resilience and persistence, because I had to be in that meeting. We couldn't cancel the meeting. I could not, we'd been prepping for it. We'd been courting that client. I could, and now we'd finally got an opportunity and got a foot in the door. There was no way I was not going to be in that meeting.
But then I also wonder, because it sounds like the dynamic that you had with your sponsor at the time helped you. Like, as much as he was overwhelmed by the situation, you were kind of in it together.
Absolutely. And, you know, he tells that story now and he laughs about it now. When he was saying to me, trying to convince me it wasn't that bad and it would be fine. You're absolutely right. If I hadn't had that great working relationship with him, and I did, I had a really good working relationship with him because he knew what I was capable of. He knew and he could recognize my talent.
That is a blessing that he was there and you were together. Can I ask, how do candidates find a culture that really values bravery and essentially is a space to thrive?
It's really hard because when you're interviewing at different organizations or agencies, it's a bit like buying a house. Everybody makes the house look beautiful. So, you know, everybody tries to mask over the bits that are problematic, you know, the plumbing doesn't work or there's a damp patch here and everybody masks over it. So when you're at an interview and they should be trying to entice you as much as you want to work for them, because it works both ways, everybody tries to present a fantastic picture of what that organization organizations like. It's hard to sort of dig a bit deeper into the culture, but the thing that you can, I mean, there's certain questions that you can ask. I mean, you can ask that question. I mean, that's a really good interview question. When people talk to you and interview you and say, have you got any questions? That's a really good one to ask. How do you recognize and reward bravery in the organization? Mm. That's a really good turn it back on them and just ask directly, or ask for their retention and attraction statistics. People that are loyal, people that can, but they change roles. So you don't want people that have stayed in the same role all the time and they don't go anywhere, because that sort of says a lot about a culture. But people that have been at an organization, like I've been at, you know, WPP since God was a boy, because there's an organization which actually it recognizes innovation, it recognizes and acknowledges bravery, and it moves you around so that you can sort of experience that in other areas. So, but I also think, you know, you've got all the normal sources, haven't you? You've got all of the, you know, we're in a world of social media, so you've got things like Glassdoor where people can, you know, always recognize the fact that there may be some disenfranchised employees on it, but just have a look at that. Have a look at some of the awards outside of industry awards that some of those agencies and organizations have won. So outside of, you know, a campaign or a can, what are the other awards that some of those agencies have won? But I do think that the best way is just really trying to ask that question directly.
I suppose we think about the things that we can do and like go on a search and do our research and a bit of an inquiry to get these answers. And the reality is how your experience of it is only going to be experienced. But you can just also ask the question, see what the response is. And sometimes the simple answers are the most powerful.
But look, your very first question to me about, you know, what's gone wrong, or your second question, what's gone wrong and how have you learned from it? That's, a really good question to ask at an interview. Because again, that recognizes or acknowledges or starts to, you can start to unpick whether or not somewhere's got a blame culture or if it's about learning from mistakes. Because if an organization says we don't make mistakes, I pretty much wouldn't join. That's not true. My son has, so it's just me and my son. And when he was younger, I always used to try and have male nannies for him. So he got both, you know, female and male stimulus. One of his nannies, Anthony, he was amazing. You know, when Isaac wasn't picked for a rugby game or wasn't picked for a football game or hadn't done as well on a test, and it's become a sort of family motto and mantra. He'd always say, minor setback, major comeback, because that's about how you learn from it. So asking that question of an organization or the person interviewing you, what's been the setback, and waiting to see if they've come back from it, if they've learned from it, is a way of seeing if an agency or an organization's got a blame culture or if it's got a growth culture.
Oh my God, this has been such an enriching conversation. I'm so, so grateful.
Oh, bless you. My absolute pleasure. It really has been.
Amazing. Well, are there any last bits that you want to add?
Do you know what? The only thing I'd say is, for every rejection you get, it may not feel like it at the time, but it's going to enhance the person you become. I mean, when I first tried to get into the industry, I got rejection after rejection after rejection. And I do think if you go through that, it toughens you up a bit. It does make you a little bit more resilient, and it makes you a bit more determined. Don't give up. And it's okay to join somewhere and realize that it's actually not the right place for you. If you've tried it, but everything in your gut tells you this is not the place for me, listen to your gut. And I've had that in my career as well. It's literally joined somewhere, thought it would look bad on my CV if I left quickly, tried to stay, but everything in my gut told me this culture is not one that I'm going to thrive in, and it's one that's going to make me less of who I am. Because it was a culture at that time that did not celebrate difference. It tried to make you a clone, and I just knew that's not where I'm going to thrive. So always trust your gut.
Well, when I thought that you had filled the cup up, it's now overflowing. Thank you.
My absolute pleasure. It really has been.